time for the newcomer ask portion of the program. Most of you have seen this box in the back of the room, and the pencil's falling out of it. We put pencils and 3x5 cards back there with this box, and what we encourage people to do is, if a newcomer to the program has questions about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, write those questions down on the cards, put them in this slot here. We will then select the question at random to be answered with AA-approved literature and our panel of experts. We had a great question submitted this week concerning the term functional alcoholic. We're not going to deal with that this week. We want to submit it to a group conscience, and we're going to take that question and answer it next week. But this week's question concerns the history of Valley Group, which is going to be answered by our own Bill H.
I don't want to answer the question now. Tiffany from New Visions asks, when was the Valley Group first formed? And I'm happy to report that the Valley Group was first formed in 2008. Our first meeting was held on Wednesday, the 8th of September. Our format was created based on a few groups down in Southern California, the Pacific Group, the Sunset Group, and the Bellflower Big Book Group, all of those, again, in Southern California. So keep those questions coming. Thank you.
And good evening again, ladies and gentlemen. It is now time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. And now, let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker has been a sober member since 2005. She has been secretary at numerous meetings, organizing so many potlucks that she acquired the nickname of Pat Luck. Her name is up there, 1205. It is on our wall of fame. She is the current secretary of the Freedom Fellowship. Her AA motto is that Alcoholics Anonymous is a design for living that works. And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from Visalia, Patty.
Hi, my name's Pat. I'm an alcoholic. It's been a while since I've been at this podium. My sobriety date is January 2nd, 2005, and I am very grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, the program, the 12 steps, the sponsors, and my friends that helped keep me sober. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I'm going to... The clock's got to glare. I might go over. No. My mom's full-blooded Native American, and she was 16 when I was born, and then she had my brother when she was 17. And when she turned 21, she left my dad and left us with my dad. And so I grew up, and a couple years later my dad remarried, but I grew up without having a mom, and I missed that. And when I got to my mid-school years, I started to wonder why. And I never asked my dad. I never talked about it with my stepmom. It just seemed like it was a topic not to be discussed. And I grew up very quiet and shy. But I had really good friends. The friends I met in the sixth grade are my friends today, still. And I feel really lucky for that, because I always had a good group of friends that, you know, we could go have fun with. And after high school, we did the high school stuff and the experimenting with alcohol and other substances. And most of the other substances I tried, if I did it once, I usually didn't do it again. It was pretty serious stuff for me. The alcohol, I loved alcohol. It turned that shy girl into... it brought out my personality. And I wasn't afraid to talk to anybody, and, you know, I really liked it. But I drank a lot fast. My typical partying night could consist of a pint of Canadian Mist, and I chased it with root beer, because I liked root beer. And I could pretty much down one of those, and I was pretty wasted before I ever got to the party, and, you know. But I don't know, I just liked that. I liked alcohol. I did a lot of, I made a lot of mistakes, you know, under the influence, and just the life I was starting to lead. By the time I was 19, I'd had 2 abortions, and they weren't pretty, and I don't think any 19-year-old needs to go through that. I carried a lot of guilt and shame for a lot of years. A lot of guilt and shame. I didn't know how to deal with it, and I couldn't tell anybody. And I really thought about it a long time. I thought, you know, they didn't even ask my parents. They just let a 17-year-old go in there and sign up, and if you qualified, you know, you could go. And I think I told one friend. I drove myself there, and I drove myself home. A couple years later, I did the same thing. I mean, it's just bad choices, poor thinking, and I really didn't want anybody to know. A lot of it was the guilt and shame, and I didn't want anybody to know what I had done. It wasn't very long after that. I met a man at the place I worked, and I really liked him, and we kind of lived near the same town. We're driving down the freeway after work, and I thought, I wonder. I asked him, I said, what were driving? And he said, no. And so I thought, okay. So we pulled over and started talking, and then we started meeting each other after work, and then a month later I found out he was married. And, you know, for a 19, 20-year-old, I was, you know, he convinced me that he was going to leave his wife and I should stay, and I stayed, you know, and we ended up getting married, and we had a couple of children, and I have 2 sons from him. But the week after we got married, we were driving in the truck, and I was looking out the window, and I'm kind of quiet. I'm not a loud person or really talkative unless I guess I have something to say, but I was just looking out the window, enjoying the scenery, and he goes, who are you looking at? And just the who are you looking at and the tone of voice just, like, cut me with a knife. I thought, oh, my God. Like, this person that I didn't know, the real him was coming out. And from that point on, for the next 10 years, I lived in fear, and I walked on eggshells. And I did what I was told, and I was a good mom, and I did, you know, I tried to be the best wife I could, and I started going to church, and I quit drinking, and I didn't do drugs, and, you know, before I had the kids, but when I was pregnant. I was living this, like, what I thought was a good, clean, you know, married life, and near the end of that marriage, it got pretty bad, and but in the meantime, I had befriended someone at the place I was working at that time with no intention of, you know, wanting to be with him, but we became good friends, and I started to fall in love with him, and I knew it was wrong, and I even went to the pastor, and his wife, and I said, this is what's happening to me, I don't know what to do, I'm falling in love with this man, and he's married, and I'm married, and I really wanted help, and I didn't get the help that I think I wanted the help. And I tried to get out of it, and I didn't know how to get out of it. And at one point, I didn't care. I just wanted out of where I was. And so I ended up leaving my husband and left my kids with him, and went through that whole just crazy roller coaster cycle of divorce, child custody battles, and all that that goes with that. You know, I'm going to back up just a little bit because I wanted to say that wasn't in 1990, but in 1987 I met my mom. We went to Nevada, and this was my first husband. He, you know, actually that was probably the one really memorable good thing that he did for me, and that was taking me to Nevada, and we searched for her, and we found her. It was 4th of July, and we found her in a park. It was a picnic, and she was sitting at a park bench with a gallon. It was a giant bottle of vodka. And I realized then that the stories I heard about her being an alcoholic was true. You know, she was drunk. But it was really a big reunion. I mean, it was like I got to see this person that I missed all my life, but then realized why I didn't move with her. And we stayed in contact through letters, and we never really called each other. She was very quiet, a quiet person, quiet spirited, and very sweet. And then she died in 1996 of alcohol-related illnesses at the age of 56. Then I got divorced. Hooked up with this other guy who was married. 5 years into the marriage, I knew he was, something was up, and there were several incidences where people were telling me, you know, watch out, he, you know, this girl's after him, and I even actually caught him with somebody, and I still let him come home. I was afraid to be alone. I was afraid to be alone, and I kind of tells you how much I thought about myself. I told him, I said, I don't care if you're with her all day, just come home at night. I didn't want to be alone. And then it ended up, from the 5 years before that marriage ended, from 95 to 2000, he probably moved out and moved home 4 times. I kept taking him back. My kids would be behind the door, front door, saying, Mom, don't do it. They'd be looking at me saying, Mom, don't do it. They'd be mad at me after taking them back, but I thought, you know, I'm going to give them one more try. I knew if I just, I had to know, you know, within myself that this was going to be the right thing to do, because I didn't want to let go, you know, or give them that chance. Cried a lot. I felt sorry for myself. You know, I looked back on my whole life, I thought nothing went right. You know, all the decisions I made were just mounting on me. I wasn't talking to anybody about this. I wasn't seeking any outside counseling. I wasn't drinking until, like, a couple years before the marriage actually ended. About 1997, 98, I started drinking secretly because I knew that was going to kill the pain that wouldn't go away. I was drinking and taking over-the-counter sleeping pills. That's the only thing I could get legally or without going to a doctor that I could do to keep myself from, or just to function. And so I did that, and it did release some of the stress that, you know, it just, you know, what was happening was going to happen. And then one day when I finally said that was enough, I found this Christmas card from her to him, and I put it in an envelope, a new one, and I put his name on it in my handwriting. And he opened it up. He'd come home from wherever he was living at the time. He came home for a little while. He opened it up, and it was that card from that woman when he thought it was a card from me. And without a tear and without any remorse because I was done, I said, you can leave in the morning. And it was like a big load off of me. And he did. He left the next day. I let him stay the night. But to kick him out then, it was night. But that's when the drinking started. It was like, okay, now it's on. He was out. I got my house in order. I was actually had a plan to be there probably another year, and then I was going to have to move because at the time I wasn't going to be able to afford to stay there on my own. And my son's friend's mom, who were single, you know, started getting me to go out partying with them. So I did that. I was doing that on Friday nights and Saturday nights. I lived in Lemoore, and I was driving to Visalia. And then when I moved to Visalia, so I was closer to, you know, not, but I drank, and I drove my friends. And it started off pretty fast because I was already drinking, but now I'm drinking to go out. So I got to drink before I even get in that car to go out anymore. Because I was fearful. I was angry. You know, and then I wanted to go out and find that fun that I knew years ago. You know, it was fun. I remember that. So I'm going to go out and I'm going to go find this fun. And I go to the bars and they'll tell you when my friends that I went out with, I go to the bars and I'd look for the cutest guy in the bar and I'd go over and kiss him. I didn't take him home. I just want to go over and kiss him. And they used to call me the kissing bandit because nobody knew who I was going to hit next. And I did that for a while, but I had to be really drunk to go do that. And they knew after a lot of drinks, I would watch out. And they watched out for me. But I was the one driving, and I would drive them home. And from Visalia to take them home to Hanford, that two-lane road with the trees lined, I'd see four lines, and I wouldn't tell them I couldn't see which lane I was in. You know, I just prayed that I got home. And then a guy, I used to start drinking at the pump house and Circe's and the patio and the Green Olive because I knew I wouldn't see anybody I knew there, people I worked with, you know. And I met a guy at the pump house, and he was at the bar with this girl, and she went to the bathroom, and he came over and slipped me his number. And he goes, call me. I was waiting there for somebody else to show up, and they never showed up. And I thought, oh, I wonder if I should call him, you know. But I was drunk when I called him, so I didn't even get to call him in my right mind. And we ended up meeting, and then we started dating. He drank like I drank, and he drank at the places I like to drink. So we started doing that, and 6 months later, we're living together, and... And then it was, I noticed he drank too much. I thought, he had the bottle in the car, he'd come home and he had the tall glasses, I mean, Jack and Coke. And it was just a lot of alcohol all the time. And I thought, it's just like way too much. But really it was an excuse because I really didn't want to be in that relationship anymore. But I really used that against him that, you know, that he did drink a lot. I drank a lot, but I realized that, you know, I wanted that drinking buddy, and he was, you know, he drank, and, I mean, he would drink and go pass out up in the bedroom, and he'd leave me on the floor in the bathroom downstairs. I wake up in the morning, and I thought, what? Why didn't he help me up to, you know, why am I waking up on the floor in the bottom of the apartment, you know? My oldest son was living with me at the time for a little bit, and he wrote me an email, and it was heart-wrenching. He goes, Mom, at no time do you need to deserve to be treated this way. He goes, there are plenty of fish in the sea, and you might even find them in the supermarket. And when he wrote that, it was like around Mother's Day, and by June, I had packed up my car, stuff full packed, and got a storage company to come and get the rest of my stuff, and I moved out in the middle of the night. And I stayed at a hotel for 6 weeks until I got an apartment in a gated community because I did not want drive-bys. I did not want anybody to feel like it. I didn't want stalkers. And so I did that. And I, you know, I was glad I did, but I was right across the street from Applebee's now. And now I had to drive myself. So, but I'd go over there and drink and come back, and, you know, I could just walk across the street. But, 2003, you know, I'm drinking every day, almost, if not maybe 5 days a week. I maybe not drink on Monday and Tuesday at first. And then every day after work, I would think about going to happy hour, because I worked in Reedley, and I would drive home, and I lived over just down the street here, off of Goshen, those apartments down there by near Acres, and I would come home from Reedley, come this back way, hit Applebee's at happy hour, and then come home, or go home, then go to Applebee's, and then, you know, do that thing. And one particular night, because I knew I was drinking a lot, and it was kind of, you know, just kind of thinking I need to do something different, and I remember going to the store, Save Mart right there, and I pulled out of the parking lot, and I thought, you know, I should just go home. I always tell myself that a lot. I should just go home. You know, if I go, you know, I should just turn right and go home. Or I could just stop at Applebee's for a couple, you know, and then go home. And I made sure what I bought wasn't going to melt, like ice cream. So my groceries were safe. Okay. But I distinctly remember asking myself, I went to Applebee's because, heck, I lost that battle of trying to decide, and I didn't really fight very hard either. But I used to think those thoughts a lot. Should I, shouldn't I, should just go home? I went over there and I had, of course, the tallest beer, and then had another one, and another one. And then the bartender gave me some shot she made. It tasted like peanut butter and jelly. I don't know what it was called and what it was made with, but it really tasted like peanut butter and jelly after it went down. And then another short beer to go, because I was ready to go home, to go drink some more, to go out. And this was Tuesday. Tuesday, and I don't know if that day was Tuesday. I know the second one was a Tuesday. It was the middle of the week. And that's just what I did. You know, that was the second DUI. That wasn't the first one. Oh my God, the first one was, I went into blackout after drinking at, oh my goodness, the, out at Riverland. I went home down 99 and would stop at Riverland. So if it wasn't going down the short way to Applebee's, it was down 99 Riverland. And Riverland one, I did drink, went into blackout for 6 hours, got arrested out in the country somewhere, don't remember anything. I was devastated. That was in 2003. Went to AA. Oh, I got my DUIs mixed up. I thought, wait a minute, that's the second one. Because that was a Tuesday night. This one was a Friday night. The first one, because after that blackout, and the next day going to jail, humiliated, sick, disgusted with myself, my car was impounded, I don't remember anything, and I told my kids, I said, somebody put something in my drink. And they used to tell me, they said, well, maybe you went in a blackout. And that's when I got sent by the courts to AA. I had to do some, you know, they gave me a weekend in jail, which I didn't think I belonged. Though the sheriff that walked me across the yard said, you're just like them. And when I got in there, I remember meeting a girl in there, and she was in there for a year, and when I left, I felt really sad. I felt like I was just like them. I was there. I'm like them. They're like me. We were the same. And I put that behind me. I did what I had to do, paid the courts off, went to the meetings. I didn't belong, didn't listen, didn't understand. July 2003, my brother, the one that was a year younger than me, he died alcoholic overdose. Right after he got out of DDI for the umpteenth time, he was the alcoholic. You know, in my eyes, he was the train hopping, paper bag drinking out of homeless alcoholic. And I hated alcohol for a couple weeks. I didn't drink. I went 2 weeks without a drink back then. But I did the program, and then I got it behind me, and I thought, you know, I'm going to change the way I drink. And where I go, and I'm going to wash my drink, I'm going to make sure it's a bottled drink, or if I have a mixed drink, I'm not going to leave it on the counter. And in December of 2004, I got my second DUI, and that was the one where I went to Applebee's. And it was a Tuesday night. I went home after Applebee's. I drank some more. I got dressed because I wanted to go out. I knew something's out there. And I didn't want to miss that, whatever it was. And as soon as I walked into the bar, there were people that I recognized that knew me, and they were buying me beers already. And I drank until I had an automatic timer in my head. About 12:31, my body just walked out of the bar. I didn't tell anybody I was leaving. If I was with people, I knew not to leave at 2 when everybody else did. I'm the only one leaving at 12:30. Get in my car. I'm the only one they got to watch. I'm sure that's just how it works. I should have done it differently. But I did. I left, and I don't remember driving. I don't remember leaving the bar. I remember leaving the bar, and I remember getting my car, because my car was the only one on Main Street. But I didn't see any other cars coming, like no cops down the road. And I got my car, and I started to drive home. And I went to the McDonald's on Demery, and right there on Demery, and got one bite on Mineral King. I don't remember going in there, but I had food from McDonald's, because I got pulled over. The light came on, and I woke up, and I pulled over, and the cop just did whatever he's got to do, and he looks at me, and he says, "You got a drinking problem?" And I looked at him, because I was just sick. I was just sick and fearful, and he goes, "I'm the one who arrested you the first time." And I was sick. I didn't say anything. He cuffed me. He put me in the back of the car. I told him, "I don't want the breathalyzer. I want to take blood." But I'm on Demery. The jail is like around the corner down. No. 2 minutes to get over that. I don't remember any of that. A few days later, I had bruises up and down my arm. Like they probably couldn't find a vein, or I thought they abused me. I was so angry. I don't know what happened. I still don't know. I don't remember. The next thing I remember is when we pulled up to the jail. And they booked me and all that stuff. And I tried to look halfway decent in this picture because I know the last one looked like... I looked like... It was horrible. This one I thought, oh, this picture's going to be better. I did. But I got it that my son picked me up the next morning. And I actually went home, I was still drunk, and I went to work. I wasn't going to miss work. The next week, I called an 800 EAP number from a work provided help for whatever I needed help in. And the guy on the phone, I started telling him I was crying. I was crying, just depressed and desperate. I didn't know what to do. All my guilt and shame from my whole life was catching up with me, and I felt like a loser. Couldn't even live my own life, you know. 2 divorces, and I've just got 2 DUIs now. And the guy on the phone said, "I'm an alcoholic." He goes, "Do 90 meetings in 90 days. He goes, "Stay on the phone. I'll get you some appointment with some counselor, outside counseling." So I stuck in my head. I didn't think of AA, you know. And he said that, and I just thought, I know where there's a meeting. And I went to the Blue Room on a Sunday night. I got there early. I was meant to be there late. And the girl at the table was sitting there with her son, Tina. Some of you might know Tina. And she looked at me. I was sitting at the door by the corner still. And she waved me up to come front. And I knew if I didn't do that, I was not going to make it. And I went up there and I sat by her. From that point on, I took the suggestions. She gave me a meeting list, circled the meetings, started introducing me to friends. And I came here every morning because I lived down the street before I went to work. And I didn't have to be at work at time because I don't press the clock. But I came here every morning as much as I could, as long as I was in town, before I would go to work. And I started going to a lot of meetings, and I started meeting people, and I started being a part of, you know, and I started going to the fun things, the conventions. I mean, I beat myself when I got up and when I got here. I cried for a year. The first time I raised my hand and said, my name's God, I'm an alcoholic, just this big release of just heaviness left. And I got to get a sponsor, and I got to start working the steps. You know, by hearing what you guys said, that life gets better, I thought, I don't have anything left. I'm going to start doing this. And by the time I got, you know, to do the fourth and fifth step, I got to release all that guilt and shame I carried my whole life. It was a lot. It was a lot to carry, and I got to let it go. Losses, mostly losses. And I really felt sorry for myself my whole life. And I don't have to do that anymore. You know, life started to change step by step. I remember at the time going through them, I distinctly remember how much my life changed at each step. And it was like I couldn't wait to get through the next step because I knew it was going to get better. And each step, I come here and I read the promises and listen to everybody share. And you know, I took home what I needed, and I used to carry a little notebook and kept those little things, you know, things to keep me going or things to read if somebody said read this or that, and you know, and I would do that. And having fun and sobriety was really important, and I got to do that right away. So the friends, the girls that surrounded me and kept me in the middle, you know, of their little pack, made me keep me coming back, you know. And before long, I was, they said railroaded. They railroaded me in the secretary of the meeting. But, you know, it was the best thing for me at the time. I was six months sober or something. I did it for 6 months, and I was sweaty palms thinking I had to do it just right. And but I got to, you know, actually look at people in the eye. They came in the door and welcomed them to the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to hear, don't leave before the miracle happens. Don't leave after the miracle happens. Don't leave. You know, I mean, it's... And, you know, I'm coming up on a 7-year birthday. I don't have any intentions of drinking. When I think about drinking, it still sickens me, and I'm glad it does. That cry out to God, he heard the cry, you know. I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for leading me back to, you know, this God that I thought was punishing God. In sobriety, the first year I spent totally doing meetings, working on me. I got in a relationship. I knew after a couple months, and while in the middle of going through my steps, it wasn't the right thing, and I got out. It was hard to do, but I knew I was starting to learn about myself, and I knew why they say wait. You know, give yourself a year. What's a year? I know today. Just give yourself a year. Work on yourself. Go to meetings. Work the steps. Have fun. Gotta have fun. And don't be hard on yourself. It's one day at a time, one step at a time. My second year, I did not want to be in a relationship. I was having fun. I was learning more about myself. And practicing Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. And by the third year, I thought, I'm going to try dating. I tried Match.com. And the good thing that came out of it was I had to write a profile about myself. I like to make myself sound good. Or what did I like to do? Or, you know, what were some of the things that, I mean, it's kind of like a, write something good about yourself. That was really hard to do. I spent a lot of time just trying to figure out who I was still and what were the things I liked to do and being honest. You know, honesty, even in that, I thought, I don't want to lie. I lied on one of them, but then... Because I lied about my age. That was the only lie I told. I thought, I don't want nobody to know how old I am. And and then I had tried it again, and I told the truth, and it was okay. It was just, it didn't, I'm not, nothing became of it. But it, you know what? This, like I said, the good thing was I got to learn about myself. That was really, I saw the end result was that I liked who I was. It was like, I'm not. God has a plan for my life. You know, if I let life flow, you know, let go and let God. Those are. That's kind of like what that is. If I stay in today, not yesterday, you know, I got rid of that. Tomorrow's not here yet. I try to stay present as much as possible. I still go through anger or get anxiety, fear. All those things crop up, but I know why. You know, I just sometimes have to let it be. You know, if I don't fight it, and I know the reason. I call my sponsor. You know, we meet weekly. We go through the book. I got to go through the steps again. And so I have a better understanding. I'm aware of, you know, and if I'm not feeling good, then I need to get to the bottom of it. It's always me. It's something there that I need to just be aware of. And it works that way. So it gives me that peace and serenity that I long for. I enjoy the process. Sometimes it's not, you know, sometimes it's like, gosh, I don't want to do that right now. Because I know, sometimes I know it's just going to change, and the only pain in change is resistance to change. So, you know, letting things go, prayer and meditation. I went to a 12-step spiritual retreat this year and focused on meditation. It's amazing, you know, when you hear prayer and meditation. To practice meditation more, and you can't do meditation wrong. It's just sitting still, being quiet, and paying attention. And if you can do that, and you can just, you'll just feel, you just, it's a really peaceful feeling. You know, and I try to bring myself that, back to that again. You know, it can feel when I'm out of balance, get myself back in that road, and when I'm there and I'm present, I feel good. Being present, you know, I can feel the peace. And when I can feel the peace, I can feel the joy. And when I feel joy, I feel love. I feel love for all of you. I feel love for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope that you keep coming back, that you give yourself a year. So keep coming back. And that's all I got. Thanks.